anyone can see me. Otherwise, I'm taking my head back to you. Okay, so then let's begin. I'm sorry for the delay. It's like really rain on a foggy here.
It's very,
very untypical for December in Ottawa. But as long as it's not icy rain, it's going to be 1600. How much?
1600.
1600, okay, no rain? No. Okay, so why is it about 7 months ago, I hope. Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, so let's begin. We are up to Shema. We are in Parashat Ve'etchana, it's Parashat Vav, and it's Parashat Vav that we're going to be focusing on. Where it tells us the Hayu Hadvarim Ha'ila. And let these words be, Asher Anochi Mitzvah Hayom, that I am commanding you today, Al Rehavecha, on your heart. So Rashi comments on the word Hayom, as in today, that I am commanding you today. Lo yehiyu be'enecha, so mitzvot and the words of the Torah should not be in your eyes, because you'll have my discussion, like an old decree. Like something which is old, something that you've heard before and you've gotten tired of. She'ein adam sosna, that a person is not really interested or paying attention to it. Ela kehadasa. Rather, it should be treated as if it's brand new to you. She'akol rushin lekhanda. And everybody is rushing and running to meet it. Everybody is excited because there's something new. And Rashi is translating his own words over there. He says, Dio Tagma. Where he says it should be in your eyes like a Yotagma Yitzana, or rather that shouldn't be in your eyes like a Yotagma Yitzana. He says the Yotagma is Yitzchak HaMelech Hava'a V'Yitzchak. The word of the command of the king that comes in a letter. So like an edict. Right? Like in the current story when Ahasuerus sent out his rule, he sent out his decree, it came in a letter form so that everybody could receive it. So he's saying that when we have the chance to do the mitzvah or to keep the Torah, it shouldn't be like something that's ancient, something that's tired, something that's old, that is routine, that we're bored of it and that we're not really interested in it, but it should be something new. It should be hayom, as if we got it today. When we get something new, when it's something that's exciting and something that's fresh, we run towards it, we're eager to embrace it, and we're eager to use it. So I actually, I'm in the middle of Hashanah shopping, high into Hashanah shopping and Hashanah preparation. So everyone here is asking for an update on the gowns, who has gowns, who doesn't have gowns, which one even has gowns for, who needs one. And I took my boys on, I don't know what day it was anymore, today or Tuesday, I guess it was Sunday. I took my boys to look for suits in a certain store, I didn't find something, but they had shoes. So yesterday I got just a pair of travel shoes. And he's all very excited. Mind you, I'm being very particular about it. He's not allowed to wear them until the box. It's still in the box, right? He's brand new, shiny pair of shoes, and he's so excited. He keeps opening up the box to look inside because he's excited. And every now and then I find him looking in front of the mirror on the tiles and like almost cat hair things in front of the mirror to listen to how they clickety clack the new sound of the bottom of the shoes because he's so excited about it. So Rashi is telling us we have a chance every day to do mitzvot. The Torah is in our lives every single day. We wake up every morning. We have a chance to do something. We should look at it with rejoicing. We should look at it with excitement. And we should be pleased to do it. We shouldn't be tired of it. We shouldn't be bored. So I want to share with you a few things on along that topic. Because Hayom is today. Today is new. Yitzchak is something which is chadash. Renewal, something which we are excited about, versus where we have hegel. Hegel is something that we are ragil. Ragil means something that we're used to. It's habit. It's habitual. It's almost as if, you know, we do it on, you know, like autopilot. You know, sometimes we get in the car, we drive to work in the morning, and we find ourselves there, but we have no idea how we got there because we're just doing it out of habit. So what we're going to discuss today is the benefits and the pros and the cons of renewal versus habit. And we're going to see that there are pros and cons to both. And we're going to see how, in different times, how one outweighs the other and how we can use both to help us in our Avodah Hashem and serving Hashem. I want to start, well, actually, it wasn't the first thing that I had here, but I think I want to start off first with Rabbi Kranz. Rabbi Kranz has a book that's, I guess, based on his Hebrew, Rabbi Kranz on the Parshat, volume 2. And he, I found in Parshat Tzav something very interesting, which applies to what we're talking about today. So he says in Parshat Tzav, the opening psukim of Parshat Tzav is talking about the job of the Kohen in the Beit HaMikdash. What he did in the Beit HaMikdash, and how he was supposed to appear for the start of the day. And there were two mitzvahs. There were two things that he was required to do to start off the day. Number one is called Teruah HaDefen. Literally in English, that means hiding the ashes. What does that mean? I can, like, people speak in real language. And that said, every day, when he would go to the Mizbeah in the morning, no matter how full the ashes were, how full the ashes were on the Mizbeah, no matter how many offerings he bought the day before, and how high the ashes were, he could have maybe bought only one offering the day before, or maybe it was a 50 day or 100 offerings. I don't know how it works with it. Somebody says how many offerings are bought a day, but some days were more, some days were less, if it was a Yom day or a Shabbat day, they were supposed to, you know, there were presumably there were more Shabbats that were bought. But no matter how many ashes were on the Mizbeah, what he was supposed to do was he was supposed to take his hands, gather one handful of the ashes, take it off the Mizbeah, and put it beside the Mizbeah. Regardless of whether it was full or not, always every morning, one scoop, put it on the side, and then it's a big day. The second mitzvah that we have is called Hosa'ah Hadeshen. Hosa'ah Hadeshen means removing the ashes. What does that mean? That means that only on days when the Mizbeah was full of ashes, but this didn't happen every day, this happened maybe every 2 days, every 2 weeks, depending on how busy it was at the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen had to take all of the ashes that were on the Mizbeah and take them and take it to a short place outside of Har HaBayis, away from the Beit HaMikdash, away from the mountain where the Beit HaMikdash was on, and he could take it out. So now, again, we hear two things. No matter how full, you take one handful every day. No matter, and then the other one is not every day, it's only one is full. So we can understand why it makes sense that we only empty it when it's full. And if it's full, we understand we need to remove it out. You can't work when the ashes are full. It's like the body people, right? You have all the old coals and all the old built up charcoal. You have to remove it, otherwise it's not going to work. You have to move it out of the way so you have room. But if the Mizbeah is not full, if I just emptied the Mizbeah yesterday, and I took out my handful yesterday, and the Mizbeah is not full, then why don't I just leave it there? Why isn't the point to leave it where it is? And then as it gets fuller, you remove it, you take it away. And again, what's the purpose of doing this every single day? So Rabbi Kranz tells us that Rav Hirsch discusses the theory. According to Rav Hirsch, he tells us that these halachos of the Kohanim are not only teaching the Kohen about daily life, but it's also teaching all of us about our daily life and about how we should run our life both in a physical way and in a spiritual way. What is that? So he says, the Beit HaMikdash and the Kohen was like a business. The Kohen was the head of the CEO of the business, and he ran the business. All of us work for a certain company. Whether we work at home, we run our household, whether we work in a job and we're part of an industry, we're part of a workforce, and there are certain things that need to be done every single day to start the day. So every morning I wake up, I get dressed, I come out, I flip open the light, I open the shade, I turn on the hot water kettle. There are certain things that I do every single day. Right? When the principal comes into the school building or the office manager comes into the building, they unlock the door, they undo the security clothes, they flip on the light, turn on the heating, turn on the air conditioning, get their computers up and running. There are certain things that have to be done every single day. And the daily startup is what's important because without those things, it can't start. And even if it could start, it's not starting with the proper perspective. It's not going to be starting the way it's supposed to be. And he actually gave an example, which probably a lot of us have said at one time or another, And for Sam to say, well, I cooked supper yesterday, why do I have to cook supper again today? Right? We've heard that. We've wondered about that, right?
Oh, I
what's it yesterday? Why do I cook this again? You can't do that. You can't say, well, I spoke to the customer yesterday, why do I have to speak to them again today? Right? I put them on the lights yesterday, today we'll sit in the dark. It's not going to work. It's going to be a failure. That's in our physical life. But the same thing applies also to our spiritual life. If we wake up in the morning and we think, well, I did that yesterday, then our day is not starting properly. Our day is not starting with the best day that it could possibly be, because today, if I feel like, oh, I didn't go right yesterday, I'm going to go around my life by trying to laugh, and I'll be laughing lazy throughout the day. Maybe I will, maybe I won't, maybe I'll do this, maybe I won't. And it's not going to focus anything. It's not going to accomplish anything like that. And the whole purpose why you're put inside this world, why we're here, is to do mitzvot and receive the Torah. So by definition, doing the mitzvot is what gives us the benefit of that gift of life that we're given every morning when we wake up. So when we want to have that gift of life, then we need to be using our life to the fullest way possible that we can. And he gives a story. He doesn't say who the story happened to, but he says it's a Talmud Chacham, a story of a wise person, a big rabbi that the story happened to. And he woke up one morning, he discovered that he was blind. He woke up and tried to open his eyes, and he couldn't see anything. He was panicked to the very spirit. Then he said he ran to the doctor, but probably couldn't go himself. He asked somebody, rush him off to the doctor. He goes to the doctor, and the doctor's examining his eyes, and he says to him, tell me, like, when did this trouble begin? What happened to you? When did this start? He said, well, last night, everything was okay. I went to sleep, but when I woke up this morning, nothing. It's all right. I can't see anything. The doctor said, that's impossible. It doesn't make sense that you were able to see yesterday and overnight. You can't see. Your eyes are so, so bad. Your eyes are so damaged. Your eyes are so hurt. You should have been blind for weeks, months, maybe even years. I don't understand how you managed with eyesight like this for so long. And the rabbi said to himself, I know it. Over the last bit of time, I've been feeling kind of weary. I've been feeling kind of run down and burnt out. And I used to keep myself busy with writing stories. I wrote my own Hebrew poem, and I would publish them. And I was very busy with that. And now I'm starting to feel so worn out and weary. I said to myself, you know what? I need to stop. This is it. This is as far as I go. As soon as I finish this book and I give it into the printer, I'm not writing any more poems. No more books. Yesterday, I went to the printer and I handed him my manuscript. And today I woke up. So now they claim Jesus that as an example of saying how the rabbi's eyesight was given to him as a gift to accomplish. And once he wasn't going to use it to accomplish, he doesn't need that gift anymore. So the point of the lesson, as for Rabbi Kranz, is, of course, use the gifts that we have to their maximum. You can lose it, right? Use them to our maximum potential. So that's our point. By removing the ashes, by the going to the Mizbeach, taking out the ashes every day, he's reminding himself that today is a new day. Yesterday was yesterday. Tomorrow will be tomorrow. But today I have today. Today I have today, that's a new change. But there's another lesson. And the second lesson in that is that what I did yesterday, I'm going to do today, and I'm going to do it tomorrow. In Judaism, we don't look for innovation. In Judaism, we're creatures of habit. Whatever we did, we will do, we have done, and we continue to do. Right? Mr. Cohen, or Rabbi Cohen, every morning takes out the ashes. What did we do yesterday? Take out the ashes. What is he going to do today? Take out the ashes. What is he going to do tomorrow? Take out the ashes. What about us? Right? In politics, we used to have like elections coming up in the state. And there were elections recently in Canada. People get tired of their leaders. People get tired of the board. People get tired of government. So it's time for a change. They want something new. They want something else. It doesn't work like that in our current life. Every day, we wake up. We dive in chocolate. We dive in income. We dive in marriage. Every day, it's the same kilo, three times a day.
Every week, it's Shabbos. Every Rosh Chodesh, it's Rosh Chodesh. It's the same thing again and again and again. Nothing changes.
And just like when we look at the day of our mitzvah, we get to film for the very first time.
And he's so thrilled. It's one of those stories. And he's so excited. And he feels so grown up. And he feels so mature. And he watches him napping around the pillow on his arm and he's feeling so proud.
We hope that enthusiasm lasts forever. Right? We know that as we do things often, enthusiasm starts to wear out. It's less exciting. And just becomes to be a bother. You know, we say Seder at the Omer. For the first night of the Omer, we're standing at the Seder, we stand up and we make the bracha. Today is the first day of the Omer.
By the time we get to the Squad Bomer, by the time we get to the 33rd day, today is the 33rd day of the Omer, the 3rd day of the
Okay. You know, we get tired of it. We get bored of it. So the instruction is teaching us, as much as we do the same things again and again and again, the goal is to maintain the enthusiasm and the excitement as if today was the first day we did it. I take out a sitter and I say, no, Da'ani, if I'm in Shema, it could be with the excitement of like my daughter who got a sitter for the very first time and is hugging her sitter because she's so excited, she feels so grown up. And it's hard. It's not an easy thing to do, but that is the lesson that we're going to focus on. Okay? So that is Rabbi Graham's case. What we want to see from our different stories, we always go to different places, different people who had such a challenge. People and different scenarios where people had a challenge of either being enthusiastic about something or where it was the opposite. Not that they weren't necessarily enthusiastic about something, but things became so careful, things became so persistent for them and so repetitious that it became either hard for them to change a mida, to change a characteristic, or something actually became easier for them. So I'll fill you in on what I'm saying. And there's a little bit of both. We're going to see now how consistency can be bad, or how it could be good. That's what we're really trying to do. Okay? So now, here we have it, that every person has in themselves the ability to I guess we say become a creature of habit, right? Humans are creatures of habit, and when we feel comfortable with something, when we're in a routine, regardless of what it's like, there's a certain comfort level, whether it's good or bad, we have a comfort level, and it's easier to be comfortable and to be not comfortable, even if the change will make us more comfortable. Let's take an example of two people in the Torah who had a certain situation. The situation happened to both of them, but their reactions were very different because of how they were prepared for it. So let's start with Abraham and Sarah. Abraham's 10th and final test was Akedat Yitzchak. Abraham was told to shoot his son Yitzchak for an Akedah, for a carbon. But he was just told, okay Abraham, let's go, bring Yitzchak, we're going to chop him off. He wasn't told that. Hashem broke it down to him. Hashem said it in very close. He said to him, the prophet said, I know, Hashem said, Hakla et Pincha. Adam, I need you to do me a favor. Please. This is the word now. Very please. Take. And we know that in the Torah when it says take, and it's spoken without a human, we're not actually insisting that the person lifts up the person and brings them, but it means to take with words, and to advise them, and to encourage them to come along and to be part of the process. He said, please, Abram, I need you to take, I need you to draw with positive words, Pinchas, your son. And there's a pause. Because that gives Abram a chance to speak. Pinchas, my son, Hashem wants you to take my son. I have two sons. I have Yitzchak, and I have Yitzmael. Which son is he talking about? Hashem continues. And here's Yitzchak. Your only son. And there's a pause. And again, Abram says, well, only son. Yitzchak is an only son from his mother, Sarah. Yishmael is an only son from his mother, Hagar. It could be either of them. And then Hashem says, Asher Ahasa, that you love. And Abram says to himself, I like them both. Okay, I like them both. And Yitzchak,
Oh, you're talking about Yitzchak. Okay, I'll take Yitzchak. And he goes and he brings Yitzchak to the Akedah and he is prepared to do this. While Avram and Yitzchak are at the Akedah, Sarah is home. Sarah doesn't know anything about that. She wasn't told and she wasn't asked permission. Because what was supposed to happen was that Avram was supposed to bring Yitzchak, then was going to stop him, and everyone would come home and would be none the wiser. But no, it doesn't happen. Unfortunately, the Satan got involved, and he showed an image to Sarah of Avram standing with a knife over Yitzchak before he was told to stop. And immediately when Sarah saw that, her Nishama left her. She died. She couldn't handle that. She couldn't handle the sight. So the Chachamim, the Chazal are asking, why was Avram able to handle it? He was actually able to go and to do it. Sarah couldn't handle it. And by the Chazal standards, it tells us that Sarah even was on a greater level of Nebuah, of prophecy, than Avram. So on some degree, she was greater than Avram. Why couldn't she do what Avram did? And Chazal answers that it's the fact of that Hashem built it up for Avram, and Sarah didn't have that built up. It's called paragraph. It's called consistency. It's called being used to something, getting used to a certain level. By the time Avram had to go and bring Yitzchak for the carbon, he was already used to the idea. It didn't startle him as much as it startled Sarah. So in that case, consistency was good, and absorbency was a good thing. Another person is there. Hushim, the son of Dan. Hushim was the son of Dan, which means he was the grandson of Yaakov. And it tells us that when they took Yaakov to be buried, Yaakov was laying and awaiting his burial, and there was all kinds of procedures that were delaying the burial process. And the Shvatim were, of course, very intent on getting him buried as soon as possible. But at the same time, they were so into the details of how to get him buried that that in itself was causing the burial to be delayed. Hushim, I think, was his death. And he didn't understand, he didn't see everything that was happening. All he saw was that his grandfather was being disgraced by not being buried as immediately as he could have. And he rushed and he pushed everybody, he has to take his gear up right now, we can't leave our grandfather Yaakov like this, what's going on? So then, he said the same question. The Shvatim didn't know that it was important to bury Yaakov right away. The Shvatim didn't realize that there's a spot for them to come up the longer that they're not buried, and they wouldn't have wanted to bury him sooner. How come Hushim was the only one who noticed that? Why was Hushim the only one who was so intent? No, wake up everybody, get this over and done with. It's not here, it's not right. And again, the answer is similar. Because the brothers, the Shvatim, were being the kata, because they were the ones who were actually working on the process of getting him buried, they actually got desensitized over those moments that it was taking and the time that it took, it became a hetero for it. So then, to some degree, they lost that level of sensitivity because they were already used to the fact that Yaakov was sitting here and waiting to be buried. Hushim was not part of that process, so he still had the sensitivity that they had just a few minutes ago. And he was able to encourage them to forget about whatever they were doing, deal with the politics and whatever bureaucracy after, and take care of Yaakov's right now.
Didn't
Joseph
know
Asa from
that?
Yes. Right. Okay, so that's what he did, right? Zachariah is reminding us that what the Hushim did, I think it was a back and forth with Asa and negotiating who was going to bury him, how he was going to be buried, and he is my dad, that was the famous story that the kids will love, how Asa's head ended up in the Arkham of Canaan. That rolled on. Okay, right? That's the story that everybody loves. Okay, another person. Another person in the story of the Navi, in the time of King Shaul. There was a man by the name of Palki ben Lahish. Palki ben Lahish was a man from a Jewish person, I don't remember what state that he was from, and Shaul wanted him to marry his daughter, not knowing that David had already agreed to
to marry this daughter. And Saul did not realize that according to Halakha, David was already married to this woman because they already had Hebrews. There was already some sanctification or some set aside that she was already set aside for him to be married, although they were not actually married yet. So according to Halakha, once there is Hebrews, this woman is considered an Ephraim. She's considered a married woman. She's somebody else's wife. Saul was unaware of the fact and gave a kingly order. There was an order by the king that Halki Ben Marduk should marry this daughter. Halki knew of the situation between David and Saul's daughter, but he couldn't go against the king. That's another whole story. He couldn't go against the king, but he also couldn't marry this woman because she was already technically married. A lot of times she was married. He could not marry her. So what did he do? In order to prevent himself from marrying her, and reminding himself that she is a married woman and he is not allowed to go near her, he took a sword, stuck it through the ground in their home, and he said, whoever removes this sword should be killed with the sword. With such strength and with such emphasis to remind him not to do it. Now think of that. A little bit childish, perhaps. He is the one who puts the sword there to remind him not to do something. Right? He is the one who needs to remind himself, stay away from this woman. She's called your wife, but she is not. She's married to someone else. Don't touch her. And this is the symbol of do not touch her, or you'll be punished. If he takes a heart of it, and it's too strong for him, and he's not feeling like he's able to overcome his Yitzhara, take away the sword and hide it in the other room. Who's going to spare him? Nobody. He's the one who put it there. Who knew it was there? Nobody. It was there for him, by him. The same way, you know, I have rules in my classroom. And this was actually one of my husband's teaching principles that he taught me. I started teaching before me, but I learned a lot of things from him.
So here's one of the principles.
At the beginning of the book here, you make a list of rules with the class. You discuss what's important with your class and how to run your class, what's important to you, and you make a list of rules, and then you hang it on the classroom wall. And it's there for everybody to see. It's obvious what the rules are. And then if a kid says, oh, can I still run in class? And you say, I'm sorry. Number five, the rule says, no gum chewing in class. And they go, please, 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 I want to chew gum. The rule says. What do you mean the rule says? Who's the rule? The rule is you. You're not a teacher. You wrote the rule. But no, it's no longer personal. It's not about me and life and me and you. It's not a conversation. It's the rule. The rule says. No subject, right? So here's the easy thing, like this sword. It's not about me and my. It's the sword says, do not come here, this lady. So he knows, do not move the stick. He can do this at any time. So what he was doing was acting upon his initial emotion of dedication to doing what's right, so that if over time that strength of fortitude, of sticking to that principle, would wane, he would have a constant reminder of what is the appropriate way to act. And in fact, he is alluded to in Asa's Kyle. In Asa's Kyle that we sing every Friday night, we say, Rabo Bano Asu Hayo, the Aunt Alis Al Kuna, Kumana. Many people have become strong, and you have risen above them. So Chazal tell us that the many people who were strong and showed strength were Yosef and Boaz. Both of them had an opportunity to speak with a woman that they shouldn't have been with, yet they strengthened themselves that they didn't. But the Adalis Al-Kumana, you are stronger than all of them. That's referring to Halki Ben Marduk, this man who overcame and stuck the sword in the ground and was able to do that. So we see how we need sometimes methods to help us maintain our enthusiasm and our awareness. When we start something new, when something is chadash, when it's a finish for us, this new concept, to be able to continue and bring forth that excitement to other times and for the future as the excitement waits. Let's look also into Pirkei Avos. In Pirkei Avos, it tells us that when we think of the Torah, and we think of the Mitzvot, and we think of the Chachamim, it says the Hevei shows that it's summoning and sedrata. We should drink thirstily, like we're dehydrated, in a word. A person who's dehydrated will gulp down water, and will be so eager and so excited to have their thirst quenched. So the same thing is, a person's normal reaction would be to be turned off from something that he's done again and again and again. Now right now, the kids were talking about what do we have to suffer. So the little kid says, pizza, pizza, pizza. Okay, fine, I'll make pizza dough, and then you'll put on cheese and sauce. You can take out bagels, you can make pizza bagels. And one daughter says, nah, pizza again, right? Even something which you love so much and you're so enthusiastic about can become so sickening and so nauseating. You're like, I can't eat pizza, Mom. I can't think of what it's like. The easiest thing to make. Just you little guy, you're home. Take out a bagel, put on ketchup, and I'm done. Supper's done. I did something yesterday, right? I'm doing it today. I'm going to do it tomorrow. Why can't we make the pizza? But no. So he tells us normally, you know, we all get bored of it. We get tired of something. But when it comes to Divrei Torah, we should be summing the mind. We should be thirsty as if, like, we need to quench our thirst and, like, run to that bottle of water. Today was a Tanis. Today was a fasting. For those that fast today, the first thing that you do after a fast, usually, is probably drink. Right? Most people drink straight to the water before they eat, because that's what's refreshing. Right? That's what's refreshing, and that's what you want. And a person who is Mizrahi, a person who is a speaker and wants to learn more, is a person who is thirsty and drinks. And he's not, and so it tells us that it's not even considered to be like a lofty idea. It's not even considered to be like, wow, that's amazing, that person is so excited to hear Torah and to do this, folks. It's telling us that that should be our level. Not even that it should be an exalted level to aspire to do, but that should be our, you know, the average level, the rank at which we should aspire to on any given day. Okay, so now, let's look at some people who were too consistent for their own good. Too consistent for their own good. Their consistency got them in trouble, even whereas they were trying to help themselves, the same thing which they were using, the same, I guess, technique or the same theory that they were using to help themselves, caused them to lose what they were trying to do. I'm talking in terms. You'll see what I'm saying. Okay? In the famous flowers, there were numerous flowers, right? There were 10 mockers. Each one worse than the next. They were hard mockers, terrible mockers. People died, property was ruined, animals died. The country was going under. Right? The country was going under. For most of the mockers, for most of them, there were even warnings. For two out of every three, there was a warning. So nothing was a surprise. They knew it was going to come. Hashem said there would be blood, they went to Kyle, warned Kyle, there's going to be blood, there was blood, it was horrible, they kept it clean, they got it, they took away the blood. Same for the flowers, right? It went through all the mockers. Come to mocker number seven. Mocker number seven is Barad and Hail. And this mocker, they were warned about also. Hashem said, Moshe and Aaron, go to Kyle, you're going to be warned, there's going to be a plague. Horrible hail, like you've never seen before, I've never felt before, is going to come, and if that's outside, you're going to be destroyed, your plants, your animals, whatever, your bike, whatever you leave outside is going to be ruined. And what do they do? I said, this person, if you're smart, you'll bring your stuff inside. I'm telling you what's going to happen, I'm telling you what's going to happen if it's outside. Here's your opportunity to listen to me and save your skin. Save your horse, save your dog, save your bike, bring it all inside, and you will be fine. And what did the professors tell us?
They did.
Some people did. There were a few people that did. But for the majority, for the most part, they did. They left their stuff outside. Really? You left your stuff outside. You were warned that something would happen. It is happening because it's not the first time. Because we're not talking about junk. We're not talking about the first place where they recall something would happen and we don't really know for sure. And we don't really know for sure that it's going to happen. he had plenty of experience, and could go on two plays lasted approximately a week. So Gross is rated number 7. We're like 2 months into this. Come on, like you should have been a little bit smarter than that. But they said, no, we're going to leave our stuff outside. Because maybe, you know what? Maybe it really won't happen this time. And it sure did. So what were they thinking? Like, where was their head? What was going on? So Chazal tell us that this is a psychological mechanism that people have. In our psychological makeup, we have a desire and we have a nature for consistency. We want to be consistent. We want things to be the same and we want to act the same when it comes to different situations. So what was the consistency? What were they trying to act upon? What were they trying to act upon? They were trying to act upon their refusal to believe in Hashem. Their refusal to believe in Hashem in regards to letting the name of Adam is right. They said with this, the Jews, sorry, Jews are really a part of our infrastructure. They are a very strong part of our economy. And if we let the Jews go, our economy is going to go downhill. We have millions and millions of free slaves. They're doing all the work, cheap labor. It doesn't get any cheaper than that. And if we agree to let them out, that's a problem. That's not going to be good. So what did they do? They said, we can't let the Jews leave Mitzrayim as a fair one, because that will be bad for us and our economy. We're going to lose money and possessions and property because of it. Guess what? At the same time, they let their property outside to be ruined to prove a point that, no, we're not going to listen to Hashem. So that was their consistency. We're going to be consistent throughout. This is what we're our level of consistency. This is the level that we're covered at. This is the stubbornness that we're going to stay at no matter what. So the very thing that made them stay consistent is the very thing that caused them to suffer from what they were trying to save themselves. Right? That's consistency. In fact, it tells us that David Zahara tried to think that he stood up. And we talked about it. He was, I guess, one, two, about 3 weeks ago that night, potentially for their chronicle lesson. We didn't have a class before that, so it must have been about 3 weeks ago. We talked about the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov and the tactics, right? We talked about, what did we call inner conflict, I think we called it, right? We talked about the Yetzer Hara and the technique. So here's another level of the technique of the Yetzer Hara, is that he knows that we have this makeup, this natural makeup to be, consistent. How does he tell us that? Because let's say I wake up in the morning, and I decide today I want to be a good girl. Today I'm going to be cheerful, and I'm going to make sure that X, Y, and Z. So everyone can pick their own things. I say, okay, today I'm going to make sure that I send some adventure. And inside my head, my Yitzhahara says, Angel, you're so silly. Why are you bothering to send it an adventure? Don't you know that you just spoke less in Hara? Like, who do you think you are? You think you're such a good girl that you're sent into the adventure? You're being so righteous? Look at what you did. They say, oh yeah, you're right. That's not very consistent. Now this is all done subconsciously, right? This is all done, like in my mind, oh yeah, you know, who am I? I'm not so good. All right, you're right. I don't really need to mention it. And it's a passage of the Yetzer Hara that he uses, knowing what our actual nature is. So what we need to tell our Yetzer Hara and respond to what we learned a few weeks ago is, that's okay. There are certain times when it's okay to be inconsistent. I spoke less than Hara. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I should have done it. It wasn't the right thing to do. But why does that mean I can't get to the answer? Why does one thing preclude the other? It doesn't have to be inconsistency. It doesn't mean that I am an inconsistent person. It means I made a mistake and now I want to do the right thing. That's what it means. Here's another. When the nation left Mitzrayim, and Hashem is going to send the month, Hashem is going to send them the month to see them. And it tells us that the Pasuk that Hashem, that Moshe says, in the evening you will know that Hashem has given you food, and you will know that you have rest Mitzrayim. You will know that you are free. That's what's called a free translation. I remember as a kid, sometimes I was reading, I think it was called the Jewish Observer in those days. One of the only, that I knew at the time, one of the only Jewish periodicals that came out monthly. And sometimes I would see, like I'm trying to read it, it was way above my head, like probably in the 70s or 80s. I didn't understand it, but it was reading, and I like to read, so I would read anything I could get my hands on, even if I didn't understand it. And they would have sometimes, like on one page, they would have something in Hebrew, some proclamation by some rabbis or something, or I know something put out in Israel or some rabbi. And then there would be a page, and next to it, and the pastor would say, free translation. I never knew what free translation was. Like, free translation? I didn't pay for it. Is that what it means? Free translation? Took me here until I realized that free translation meant not exactly. You know what I mean? It's just like a summary. It's a loose translation. Why did you call it a loose translation? Well, okay. Free translation. I remember, like, it's so confused. It's weird. It's not free. I bought the magazine. It comes with the magazine. It's like, what are you talking about? Bonus with your purchase? You know, like, what was that? You know? So here's a free translation. Now, basically, you'll get money at night. You know you're free from Mitzrayim, and that will indicate that you are free because now you have money.
What kind of freedom is that?
How did that show up free? This was already days after they left Mitzrayim. They had already left Egypt. They walked out on their own two feet in the middle of the day, carrying, you know, their masses on their back, taking their whole families with them, taking all the presents that they got from Mitzrayim. How could they not know they were free? What is it about the mud falling that they will know that they're free? What is it? So it tells us that in this time, the Egyptians did not have very structured seasons. They didn't have meal time, like we are accustomed to. We have breakfast, lunch, supper, and any good nutritionist will tell you that it's important to have either some snacks in between, right? Snacks in between three big meals, or stagger your meals, so that you are not hungry and not snacking all the time, and to keep yourself, you know, from improper eating habits, they tell you the right way to eat. But apparently in the Mitzrayim, they didn't have any right way to eat. They told them to eat like chickens. The same way chickens pop around in the barnyard, they're eating from the floor all day long. As they walk, they're fucking and pecking and fucking and pecking. That's how the Egyptians ate. And of course, being that the Jews were in the Mitzrayim for all those years, 210 years, they picked up the habits of the culture around them. And they did not have proper eating habits. They ate what they kept, and they ate and they kept, and they ate and they kept, whatever they called it. Right? I think they call it grazing. You know, like they'll call it when you're trying to help your kids with the eating habits, they'll call it grazing. Like children don't need as structured meal time. Maybe they need to graze and eat small meals, more vigorous. But according to Chazal, this was not the right way to eat. The barnyard pecking was not appropriate. And it had become such a habit of it. And Chazal tells us that it wasn't become. Of people who were the Am Hashem, the people who were chosen by Am Hashem to do these pecking around, it was not appropriate. The problem is that when they left Mitzrayim and they raised their spiritual level, and as they got closer to Hashem, and as time went on in the Midrash, they got closer to Hashem, they spiritually got on a higher level, but some of the physical habits that they had stuck with them. And they didn't even realize that these habits were inappropriate because they were so used to it for so long. So Moshe had to retrain them and redirect their thinking and be bound to Hashem that they should have set meal times that helped them to feel free and to actually be free from their entire slavery and their entire servitude of the Christ. And that would symbolize that all of their habits, once all of their old habits that they took with them from Mitzrayim were gone, that was the real symbolism of freedom, that they were truly, truly free. And the Mishnah Yisrael tells us that our habits, the Mishnah Yisrael was filled with our characteristics and how to change and to work on our characteristics, tells us that our habits become so ingrained with us and become like second nature, become very hard to be broken. And at the beginning, they might not have thought that it was a good idea, but it became so ingrained in them to the point where they didn't recognize that it was no longer appropriate.
And we'll see how important seeing that are, because the Gemara tells us that when it comes to the laws of witnesses, and who could be a witness and who can't be a witness, there is a person who, if he eats in the street, is not allowed to be a witness. See, that's the big deal, right? We all, you know, we drive down the street, we walk down the street, and sometimes you see people like coming out of the pizza shop, and they're eating the slice of pizza, and so now we have no pizza. And so you see other people walking out of, you know, pizza, or whatever the names of the stores are. You see sometimes people eating things weirdly. I heard on the radio, somewhat recently, a car got pulled over on the highway for driving erratically because the driver was trying to drive while trying to eat a rotisserie chicken and drive at the same time. Okay? So people have strange eating habits. So the Chazal tell us that people with strange eating habits are not fit to be a witness. Why? What's the big deal? If you ate a rotisserie chicken while you were driving, you ate a pizza while you were walking down the main street, what's the big deal? The big deal is that they don't have a sense of self. They don't have a true sense of their own self and how special and how unique they are, that if they couldn't do that, they would not have a problem with taking money as a bribe or taking money to be a witness or to say something for any type of money because they don't have self-respect. So two the things that are not appropriate when it comes to being a witness. And we are higher than that. We're not like those chickens that peck around in the barnyard. We're higher than that, and we have to set ourselves to a level of restraint and to make sure that we maintain ourselves to a higher standard. Thank you. Here we go. The Gra tells us, and again, here we go with our teacher of our habits, so we're going to continue on that vein. So the Vilna Gaon tells us that the Yei Sahara, again, another technique of the Yei Sahara, tries to convince us why we don't have to do tshuvah. Why we don't have to make amends for things that we've done wrong. And that's not perfect. You know what? When you do something wrong, don't worry about it. Do what you want to do. And later on, when you then say it, when you feel like it, you'll do the tshuvah for it. You'll make up for it. You don't have to do it right now. You know why you don't have to do it right now? Because it tells us, and here's what the Torah is trying to be, like, you know, tricky and rabbinic at the same time, and he says, you know that when you do tshuvah, when you make amends, the things that you did wrong become a zechut for you. It becomes a merit for you because you worked so hard to undermine what you did wrong that you elevated and now it's something positive. So the Yitzhak says, wait. Don't do tshuva now. The longer you wait, the harder it will be. The harder it will be, the more zechutim you'll have. It's going to be so good for you because the longer you wait, you can have so much merit for working so hard to undermine and to underscore your actions and your behavior. And the Chacham is saying, listen to the Yei Sahara. If you do something wrong and you know it was wrong, make amends for it immediately because the longer you wait, the harder it will be. It will become your consistency. It will become your habit. And you will not be able to do tshuva for it. All those merits and all that time that he's promising you, you're not going to get. You need to stop. The true advice is, don't wait for it to become paradigm. Don't wait for it to become part of your character and part of your nature that you're so used to doing it that you think you're doing the right thing. That's always the next one. I'll tell you something. The first time you do something wrong, wake up. The second time, we're let up. And by the time it's the third time that we're doing it, we already think we're doing a mitzvah. This is what we're supposed to be doing. What's wrong with what I'm doing? So let's actually kind of sum up here with two final thoughts. When the mitzvah were freed from its fire, there are four expressions of Ula. The four expressions of salvation that Hashem uses that become the four cups of wine that we drink on Pesach. Right? The Hoseishi, right? So what are these all four? They're all four are referencing to a different form or a different level or a different meaning of salvation that
the Jews were able to achieve. So what happened? The Gehazi is referring to, Chazal tells us that the Gehazi is referring to the drowning of the Mithrin at the sea. And it wasn't until the Mithrin actually drowned at the sea that the Israelites were considered to be saved. Why? Because they should have been considered free from the moment they walked out of the triumph. The moment they left the gates of the triumph, the triumph is behind them, they're 1 foot out the door, they're 2 feet out the door, they're no longer slaves. What was the final salvation of the Mithrin drowning? And it tells us that, that already, because they had seen so many miracles, they had already seen so many things. They were in the sun, they saw all the Mithrin, they saw all the miracles, and they were actually kind of useless. They were used to the miracles. They lived in the sun. They witnessed all those things that we talked about the Mithrin avoiding. They witnessed also. They didn't avoid it, but became habitual to them. One miracle, another miracle, another miracle. Chazal tell us that miracles are not enough to change them. Because a miracle also could be something that we can become two reasons. One is that a miracle is something that is like a burst of inspiration. People like, they said like after the Gulf War, it was like this burst of Baal Teshuva and Eretz Yisrael because people saw and recognized all the miracles that Hashem did during the Gulf War, that people were just like, of course there's a God in the world, of course we have to believe in Hashem. But it slowly, as the time wore on, that enthusiasm, the bubble burst, and everything went back to normal. That's one problem of the age. The other problem of the age is that for them, they witnessed it so many times that it wasn't even a case for them anymore. The same as we wake up every morning and the sun is shining. Do we say, oh my God, wow, look, the sun is shining. What a great day, I can't believe that happened. No, because for us, it's Mitzvah, it's Eva, it's math in a room, we become habituated to it. And that's what nature is. Nature is habit. Nature is what we get so used to that we see all the time that we forget that it's a nature. So for the nature, these miracles that we call a miracle because we've never seen them, to them it was habit already. It was no big deal. So they had to wait until, even though they were physically sick, it wasn't until they saw that the mission was drowned that all of that level of everything that they witnessed in time was drowned and goodbye and finished, that they could take on their new identity as the Am Hashem. So too also, when the Nesol were in the Midbar, a lot of this comes from the Midbar, from the tiny one, the Nesol were told that they needed to take a step, a shoot, to bring it as a carbon Pesach on the 14th of Nisan. But before they could bring it as the carbon, they had to actually take the sheep home with them for 4 days. They have to let it take the sheep, bring it home, and keep an eye on that sheep for 4 days. Why? Because the sheep was the idol of the Egyptians. And as being part of the Egyptian culture, it seeps into their behavior as well. And the only way to really to eradicate that habit to them was to have them do an actual physical action demonstrating that this is not an idol. This is going to be used as a sacrifice. It cannot possibly be a god. It cannot possibly be an idol. We have to uproot any misconceived and preconceived notions that they had based on the habit that they had become accustomed to. So I think that what we see from here helps me to understand the few cases. Because habits could be good, right? We say when we're trying to learn a new skill, when we're trying to remember something, we're supposed to attach it to a habit. So let's say, for example, somebody is on, I'm on a cholesterol medication, and I'm supposed to remember to take this cholesterol medication. So the doctor says, you have to take it at the same time every day, but attach it to something so that it becomes a habit. So do it either at certain times, okay? Do it when you brush your teeth at night. Because every night you've been trained since you were young, brush your teeth before you go to bed. It's a habit. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to say, oh, why do I brush my teeth? Do I need to brush my teeth? It's a habit.
to get ready for bed, you brush your teeth. The same thing is, you start taking the cholesterol medication, which you haven't taken before, take it when you brush your teeth. You brush your teeth, you pop your pill, you take your teeth, you brush. It becomes a habit. So there is a good thing to say for when things are consistent. And again, we see that there's a negative, there's a drawback. So when things are consistent, that you don't even know, like, sometimes you can stand today and say, oh my gosh, did I brush my teeth? Why? Because it's so habitual to do that you don't even remember that you did it or not. I got myself to work and I don't remember how I got there. Like, how am I here already? Did I stop at any red lights? Did I go through a stop sign? Did all your things I did? But on the other hand, it helps us to go through life in other respects. Because when I was reading the Tikkun Mitzvah, it was saying that the same way that Avram became habituated to being able to bring Yitzchak as an Akedah, to bring Yitzchak as a sacrifice, by the slow transformation, and level by level by level, and he came to accept it. He says, so do also when we hear of, let's say, the horrors of the Holocaust. And we use the expression, it makes our ears, in Hebrew, he writes, it makes our ears stand on end. Right? It makes us bristle from the horrors. How could people have gone through that? It's horrible. And it is horrible. And not to take away from the tragedy of it and the hardship of it and the intensity of it, but the people who were living it, it didn't happen to them overnight. There were subtle changes. There was one thing changed. It got used to it. That became the new normal. Something else, it was a new law. That became the new normal. It didn't go overnight from one extreme, from being free Jews who were able to own land and own shops, to being in the concentration. And slowly, 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 the hardship became a new normal. So that's why sometimes we say, like in our life, well, this might not be normal, but it's our new normal. This is what's normal for us. This is what our life is like for us. My husband is in the hospital now. He's been in the hospital since a week ago, once he got it. We're hoping to make it Sunday and we'll be home for Shabbos. Is it normal? No. It's not normal than to be in the hospital for almost 2 weeks. But the way our life has gone over the last 5.5 years, it's become normal in our life that there are times when my husband's in the hospital. And we have our normal schedule when Abba is home. And then we revert into our other, quote-unquote, not normal, normal schedule of when Abba is in the hospital. And that becomes our new norm. A friend of mine once was saying, how was he went away for a summer or something. She was new to Iowa, and she had gone away for the summer, and she was talking about her experience being back in, you know, back in town. And people couldn't understand how she could live in a city without a farm store and a pizza shop and a bakery with, you know, a few trees. And she said, well, I guess you could get used to anything. And when I heard her say that, I'm like, yeah, pretty much you can. You know, I'm thinking, yeah, there are a lot of things that, you know, we get used to in our life. And they're not normal. And people wonder how we do it. And we wonder how we're doing it. But it becomes our consistency. It becomes our new normal. So I think what the lesson that we want to take from here is to use consistency to help us be strong and maintain our strength in times that are hard, but at the same time, use that natural desire for freshness and for newness when it comes to enhancing the quality of our life with the things that matter the most. And that is what I think I'll leave you with for the next, what is it now? So as the pace up, feels like a long time, I'm really... You know, I really had a hard time saying that I'm going to put this off until after Pesach. But I think that I really need that time, and I really feel bad. And I really hope that everybody continues to share and discuss with each other, continues to tell you about all the wonderful things that are happening. And I'm looking forward to seeing everybody again refreshed, eager to hear a new semester of what's in store for us. And at some point you have to see if I'll be in touch. I'll keep you posted. I'll let you know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Well.
Thank you.
No. Hi there. Hi. No, I just finished with your sister's class. You just woke up? Oh. Okay. How are you? Good. Oh. How do I do?
Hello.